Welcome to the Ecology and Research Channel. Green issues, ecology, incredibly important to embodiment. Obviously, we're embodied in place, we're embodied in a world. How we treat ourselves is how we treat the planet and vice versa. So this is super important, I think, for our whole planet. Research relates to this. We've sort of put two together there. We didn't quite know where to put research, so we put them in with ecology. This stage has lots of great speakers, people I personally enjoy, and it's sponsored by Forests Without Frontiers. So rather than sell a sponsorship for this channel, we decided, you know what, let's give it away to a green charity. Tree planting seemed a good one. We thought we can all get behind that. We all breathe air. We looked into a load, actually. Some of them are quite famous, but don't actually plant a lot of trees, weirdly, or other things aren't so good with them. This one, Forests Without Frontiers, really does the work. They're in charge of a really big reforestation project in Central Europe, but, you know, we're all breathing it, thank you. It's run by Nicoletta, a very cool lady, and just a cool organization that really does the work. The money goes, you know, efficiently to actually planting trees. I'm happy to be supporting them. For me, it was like, you know, when we were looking at our charities to support, a green one just made a lot of sense to me. That just was obvious. Please do support them. Links below. As well as that, enjoy the whole channel. There's so much richness in this topic.
So I'd like to introduce you to Dr. Alistair McIntosh. He's a professor at Glasgow University in Scotland, actually at the School of Social Sciences. And he has written several books, which include Soil and Soul in Autumn 2001, about rebuilding community with the land, Poacher's Pilgrimage in 2016, about spirituality and ecology of the imagination, and most recently, Riders in the Storm, the Climate Crisis and the Survival of Being in 2020, about the science and human calling that our most pressing global problem invokes. He's also a human ecologist. He was raised on the Hebridean Isle of Lewis in a traditional community. Today he lives in Govan, a hard-pressed area of the city of Glasgow. From here, a mile from his home, the leaders of the world will gather in November 2021 for the United Nations COP26 Climate Change Summit. And today he will talk about embodying community, climate change, consciousness, and cultural trauma. Why the solutions to climate change lie mostly within ourselves. The session explores climate change as a call to deepen our humanity. The solutions are only partly in politics, technology, and economics. Mainly, it's about deepening our humanity, about understanding the embodied connections between people and our place on Earth that we've lost. Seeing how this made us vulnerable to destruction and consumerism, and recovering what it takes to rebuild both community and spiritual life. So Alistair will illustrate with slides of his work from Scotland to New Guinea. Half the time will be presentation, the remainder Q&A. I'm really happy to welcome you, Alistair. I've been really looking forward to this. And yeah, I'm really excited to hear more about this topic.
Well, thank you, Catherine, and how nice it is to be here on the embodiment conference. My wife was very shocked when she heard that I was being invited on here. She said, "You embodied and so on." You know, she does all these yogas and meditations and what have you. And, you know, I get a bit of the thumbs down sometime. And I said, "Oh, have you heard of this conference?" She said, "Yes, it's huge." So, you know, it seems that all of a sudden, in my wife's eyes at least, you folk have made me famous for a short time anyway, until I until I get going on this. So, embodying community, climate change, consciousness, and cultural trauma. What brings those things together? Well, these basically are the focus of my most recent book just out, Riders on the Storm: The Climate Crisis and the Survival of Being. And also, in a different way, a very different mood of a walk, a pilgrimage through my home island of Lewis and Harris in the Outer Hebrides of Scotland, Poacher's Pilgrimage, which was published 4 years ago. And I'm going to share with you this evening some reflections around that. So let's just start with climate change. It is the most pressing issue of our time. We only know, or mostly only know, what we think we know about climate science because of the science of climate change. So in my approach to it, I stick very rigidly to the consensus expert science on what is happening. And while that science is not alarmist in the sense of saying we are likely to see massive human dieback this century or human extinction this century, such as some voices would be saying, some of the more alarmist voices would be saying, nevertheless, the consensus expert science of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is very clear that the science is alarming, that the Earth is moving into perilous conditions. And we're seeing that with wildfires, with rising sea levels, in certain parts of the world, increased storminess, and all the uncertainties that things like the melting of the Arctic and other concerns like that bring about, the effects on desert regions as rainfall patterns shift. These being caused now beyond reasonable scientific doubt by human impact on the planet. So what's that got to do with consciousness, and what's it got to do with cultural trauma? In the thesis that I unfold in Riders on the Storm, I look at what I call four C's. I look at clearance, a word that we use in Scotland for the Highland clearances, meaning the disconnection of people from the land, the disconnection, in the terms of this conference, the disembodiment of ourselves from the patch of the planet on which our forebears might have been raised. So that's what I'm meaning by clearance, and I'm going to expand on that in a moment. And I'm suggesting that that disconnection, that disembodiment from being able to be real people living in real places, leads to an inner psychological collapse, so that what happens in the outer world has resonances on our inner lives, which I sum up with the word collapse. A psychological collapse, a loss of our bearings, a loss of our sense of our identity, a weakening of our sense of being and of being fully incarnate on this planet in relationship with other peoples. And then I suggest that that makes us vulnerable to consumerism. I'll come back to that in a moment. But basically, when you've got this emptiness within, you seek to fill it in some way, and the forces of marketing powerfully drive suggestions as to how we might do that of a nature which caused destruction of the planet. And finally, what is the antidote to all of that? I suggest it's about rebuilding community. And I would like to share with folk tonight. And my goodness, I'm seeing people popping up from all over the world. We've even had one in Scotland just now. And we had somebody in Anchorage a moment ago and in Thailand just before that. So my goodness, think how much carbon footprint we're saving by doing this. By high technology tonight. So these four themes of clearance, collapse, consumption, and community are what I'd like to share with you tonight. And, you know, Catherine, it's very, and everybody else out there, it's very difficult to talk about these things completely in the abstract. Because if I talk about community and start describing place, you know, what somebody in Vietnam or in Anchorage, what are they going to make of that? Are they going to be able to immediately picture in their minds what I'm describing? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to screen share for about 5 or 10 minutes and share with you, how many have I got here, about 20 slides or so, which will just help you to place things a little bit more. And then I'm going to fill out a bit further from based on what I've said in the slides. And then we'll move to opening this up to discussion. So let's see if I can get this screen share operating. And am I in business? Yeah? Great. You keep me right. Give me the thumbs down, Catherine. If I lose it, my goodness, we've got 50 people with us just now. So I'm going to, folks, we're talking embodiment. We have to dig where we stand. You know, the first principle of embodying community is dig from where you stand. So I'm going to take you to the community where I grew up. I wasn't born there, but my father from 1960, when I was 4 years old, was a doctor in the North Lochs parish of the Isle of Lewis in the Scottish Outer Hebrides. So let's see where we're talking about. I don't know, can you see my mouse moving about there? Oh, I've lost everybody. Hopefully you can see my mouse moving around. There's the Outer Hebrides. I've forgotten, I had a little circle on it there. There's the part of Scotland that I'm talking about. You can see continental Europe to the south and Norway and Sweden over to the east there. But I'm also going to be talking tonight about the completely other part of the world, the other side of the world, because when I was 22, I went and worked for 4 years in Papua New Guinea, north of Australia there. And subsequently, I've been doing work with people in West Papua province, in Indonesian Papua, which is the name given to the western half of New Guinea. So I'm going to be sharing with you an experience last year with people from that part of the world. But I want to start, first of all, by sharing the community that raised me, the community in whose basket I was held growing up. You know, they say in Africa, it takes a whole village to raise a child. Well, it's exactly the same in any grounded community. So there we are. That's me at the age of four. In my kilt there, that was at a wedding in Stornoway with my parents attending, my sister Isabel there, my father and mother. And notice how embodied in place we would be. We'd always be paddling in rivers. We'd be out, that was me hunting rabbits there. Later out was working animals on the land and cutting hay and what have you with the scythe. So this is a kind of embodiment that I know of using one's body in a very practical work-related way that causes you to grow up not doing exercises as such, but well exercised, just because you're connected into your community and being an agricultural and fishing community, that's the kind of thing you do. But it's not just connection with the land in these ways, it's also connection with one another. That picture will be taken when my sister there in the middle would have been about eight and I would have been probably nine or thereabouts. And as you can see, we've been out fishing. We've just come back to my father's house, which doubled as a surgery. And I'm with my school friend there, Alec George Morrison, who I've known since I was 4 years old. And watch this picture here. Notice Alex's face there. And there he is today on the left was me. And there's our village behind us. So that's what our village of Lurbost looks like. And note our other friend on my right there, Rusty. Rusty, so-called Shawnee MacDonald because of his red hair, but he's also the village blacksmith. So that's the situation that I'm talking about. And I want to bring you here now, which was last April. And there's Rusty again with Catherine Mary and Evelyn from the village, the two white women you see on the right there. And we are with a delegation of community leaders from West Papua province in New Guinea. And there we are at the famous Kalanish standing stones, the 5,000-year-old stones. And they had come here to study community, but also to share from their own experience. In the course of doing that, we went down to the sea and we looked at the way in which the fishing industry had been destroyed because of overfishing. We talked about how the same thing was happening in their parts of the world. So often, you know, we're talking tonight about consciousness. One of the good things about travel is that it can raise consciousness, because often you don't know your own place until you've seen things in another place. I learned so much going to Papua New Guinea when I was 22. And I came back and those people taught me about connection to land and community in ways that I had actually been grown up in, but it wasn't until I experienced it in their different cultural context and had them explain it to me in their context that it came alive to me. And so, where am I now? Yes. I think I've muddled my slides slightly. Too bad. This always happens, doesn't it? So we're moving along. And as you can see, the tide is falling and we've been gathering shellfish. We've been gathering mussels, which are in that big pot. And notice how bonded all of a sudden people are. You know, these folk, you know, the two women in the front there from our community, Evelyn and Catherine Mary, and the Papuans behind, they've known each other for just over an hour. And you can see a conviviality already in that picture. Why? Because we've been down on the beach scrabbling together, gathering shellfish, which we're now got in the pot and we're going to stew up. Now, this is where I've screwed up my slide slightly, so let me just jump ahead. But while we're down there, you know, we're not just there for a party. We're not just there to have a mussel feast. We're there to read the landscape. We're there to read the meaning of the place itself. And I show you this slide, and you think, well, big deal, what are we looking at there? Well, can you see those streaks coming down on the left-hand side of that hill there? And the kind of hummocks along the coast there? What you are looking at there is the remains of an abandoned village. You can see in the foreground some of the ruins of the houses in that village. Nobody lives there now. Nobody lives anywhere much to the south of this for the rest of the island. It's all abandoned, or pretty much all abandoned land. But what you're seeing there is the signs of the raised beds, the lazy beds, or as we call them in the Gaelic, the fianagan, by which soil was literally made by taking seaweed and sand from the beach and mixing it perhaps with animal dung. And that was how they grew their crops. The very wet part of the world, so they had deep furrows to drain the land and raised up ground to give depth of soil. But look at what is happening. Because when I was a boy, those fianagan would have been rounded off at the ends, and then there would have been several yards of coastline until you got to the high tide mark. But now they are all being truncated off by the rising tides. Here you see another set. Here again, you know, the bits that are eaten in have been the furrows. And the raised bits, you can't see too well in this picture here, unless you look in the background there. But those are the fianagan. Again, this was highly productive agricultural land, and it's being eaten away. Now, that was not like that when I was a boy. But since I was a boy, the world as a whole has seen about 6 inches of sea level rise caused by human impacts on the environment. And in addition, you're getting it, especially in this part of the Atlantic, you're getting increased winter storminess. And so it's not just that the sea level is coming up, but when there's a gale and a storm, the waves are coming in and eating away at the land. You can see the seaweed cast up, you know, away up on the grass in that picture there. So these are the kind of signs of climate change that you can see just walking around if you keep your eyes open. And literally, the heritage of our place is being nibbled away at all the time with every high tide when there's wind blowing. And so it was that we made our way to these ruins. Now, there are ruins like this, surrounded by fianagan for bygone agriculture, all over this part of the Isle of Lewis. abandoned villages, albeit often in beautiful places like this. But there is nobody living there. And so we sat down and we had our mussel feast. And then Rusty, the blacksmith, there's Varen, my wife, behind. Rusty began, in his capacity as president of the local historical society, the North Loch Historical Society, began to tell what had happened. And how in the 1800s, around the 1820s or so, the landowner who owned the whole island, by that time was the Governor General of the Barbados slave colony in the Caribbean. And to pay his gambling debts, he leased all this land to commercial sheep farmers. And in a process known as the Highland Clearances, the people started to be evicted from the land. And Rusty told terrible stories about how people had been ordered to leave their villages. They had nowhere to live. They had to sail off in their little boats, like the ones you saw earlier, and turn them upside down and sleep under boats during their first winter until they resettled. This was happening all over the Highlands of Scotland. It was happening all over Ireland. It was happening in England further back in time with the enclosures. You wonder where the people of North America or Australia have come from. And folks, I'm telling you where a lot of them came from. A lot of those folks with Scots-Irish ancestry or English ancestry. Indeed, similar things happened in other parts of Europe. You know, they didn't just go because they felt like leaving their place and all the people they loved behind, but it was hard times and they were seeking opportunity. And this is why our island now, which would once have been, you know, all of these lochs, all these lakes, both sea lochs and freshwater lochs, many of them would have had villages all around them because there was lots of fish in the sea. You see, the land was hard to work, but lots of fish in the sea. And these places emptied out. And the people compressed largely into the north of the island. So there we were sitting there and Rusty was telling the story. And the kind of ruins we were sitting amongst are called black houses, these traditional thatched houses. Black houses. And as Rusty came to the conclusion of telling us what had happened, he spoke about one island woman called Mary Ann MacLeod and how she had emigrated to New York in 1912. And how she had been born in a black house, just like that of the ruins in which we are sitting. And he concluded, and so it was that the son of a woman born in a black house just like this now lives in a white house. And so it is that Donald Trump has been back home to the island. His family are well-liked on the island. That's his sister on the far left. That's his relatives in front of the rebuilt house in which she had been born. And I know there will be people listening to this who have widely different views of Donald Trump. Don't worry, this is not about Trump bashing. This is about understanding the story, if you like, the maternal psychological history of a son of our island. What happened? Well, there's his mother. There's Mary Ann MacLeod, as Mrs. Trump on the left. And in my final slide that I'm going to use, here she is, just after she had emigrated to America. a beautiful young island woman, as you can see. But look at what I've put in the column on the left there. Because we've sat down in the village and said, what happened in that family? And we've identified 7 layers of trauma in that family. And not just her family, but many island families of that era. There were the 1820s Highland clearances, where they were forced off their land into hardship. That would have been her grandparents' generation, great-grandparents and great-grandparents. And then, because they were moved to an area where the sea was much more exposed, there were multiple mass drownings. Her own grandfather, I think it was, drowned in one of these drownings when a squall came up at sea and their boats blew over. The tragic monument that I visited recently with all their names written on it. And then in the First World War, remember, she was born in 1912. The First World War started 2 years later. 1 in 6 of the island's young men were lost in the trenches, and a further 200 were lost on New Year's Day 1919, when a ship bringing them home to the island hit rocks and ran aground, and only 40 or so survived, some 200 drowned. The tragedy, the trauma was so great that only in the past year or two, with the centenary of that happening, has the island begun to talk about it. When we were growing up, we knew about it, but we never spoke about it. And yet we were growing up amongst people who had lost their father, typically, in that disaster. And then they were hit by the Spanish flu in 1917, 1918, 1919, thereabouts, which particularly targeted young people, as did the tuberculosis that also probably came back from the trenches from the war, and then mass emigration of young men. On the Metagama, which sailed in 1923, 4/5 of them at least were young men. And so you've got to ask, who is a young woman like this going to marry? If you could get your chance to go and seek your fortune working as a nanny in America, you took it, and that is what happened. Now, folks, what interests me in this story, again, is the psychohistory. You see, I'm not interested in the specifics of Donald Trump. I'm interested in the much wider phenomenon of particularly the Scots Americans, but it would apply to many other Americans also, who would have voted for Donald Trump and the kind of policies that he has, and who, when you trace their history back, probably have had similar things happen to them. On my shelf behind me here, let me see if I can happen to lay my hands on it. If you can hear me talking as I move along. Yes, here we are. In my shelf behind me here, I've got J.D. Vance's book. I see that the film of it I saw a trailer of it just this week. It's said to be the book, you know, written by somebody who self-identifies with hillbilly Appalachian culture. And it's said to be the book that most helps to understand what happens in this culture. And I'm suggesting to you that this is a culture of people who historically have become detached from their place, who historically have become disembodied. You move to a place like America or Australia or South Africa, you make a new community there, but always there's something lacking. Always there's that emptiness. You know, we see it so much in people who come to Scotland from those parts of the world to look up their ancestry. It's almost like, you know, an unrequited love that's running in them. And we, especially, you know, in indigenous contexts, like our village I've just described with the Papuans, people, certainly in the time when I was growing up, were not materialistic because they had each other. And they had what you got from the land. Our richness was things like putting on that mussel feast, the music, spirituality. These were our reference points. And yet, you know, imagine you go to America, you enter domestic service, or you join the military and you start killing Native Americans, or as many Scots did, driving slaves on the plantations. And you can only cope with being complicit with that kind of violence against other Native peoples by letting something in your soul be wounded, be injured. And remember, the word trauma is the Greek word meaning injury. And so in Riders in the Storm, I wrestle very deeply with the science of climate change. When I say deeply, I don't mean in scientific complexity, but in terms of the implications of what the science says. And I look at how hard it is to see what we can actually do as long as we continue to consume more and more, and we drive consumerism through our corporations in other parts of the world. And I beg the question that, you know, so much vexed me as I reflected on these things, walking through the island for 12 days, resulting in Poacher's Pilgrimage here, reflecting on what had happened in these lands and the global consequence of it, reflecting on the lectures that I give at military staff colleges in Europe, where I talk to soldiers who have killed people. And I hear from them what war is like at first hand. And I hear from them, not their brutality, but their concern, even their compassion, for how we can make the world a better place, as we must do in this, the atomic age. I reflect on all these things, and I think, you know, we are carrying in us more than we are aware of. A consequence of our disembodiment is we are not always aware of what is embodied in our psyches and what has never been dealt with. The Jungian shadow, both individual and cultural, that has never been dealt with. And that this leaves us vulnerable to the blandishments of consumerism. We get our kick from things. We get our kicks from stuff. I can't get no satisfaction because I try and I try and I try, said a great English theologian. But if we're going to tackle climate change, we've got to re-establish meaningful relationship. And that's where being held again in the basket of community is what we need to do. You know, a basket is made up of the warp that goes outwards and the weft or woof that's woven sideways. And I put it to you that in modern times, our warp is driving outwards at warp speed. And what we have to do to build community, what we have to do to re-ground and re-embody ourselves, is to weave that weft back into being whole people in a whole world again. I'm going to pause there and ask Catherine if we've got any questions coming up at this stage, because I've spoken for half an hour, and I'd just like to give that space if any of you have got questions. So how are we doing, Catherine, on that front? And maybe if people want to feed in questions, as we're talking, they can do so. So just so people know, I'm very deaf. I've got hearing aids and special Bluetooth gizmos rigged up. If I don't hear right, just put me right.
Yes, no worries. So I would like to thank you. This was actually really amazing, your talk. To me, I think we could all listen to you for more hours. But I understand that you want to know more about people's opinions. So you got a lot of feedback in the chat. People are really, enthusiastic about your talk. And maybe I can read you a little bit what's happening in the chat. So there's someone saying...
Yeah, Catherine, I should just let them know that I don't actually watch the chat when I'm talking. I leave that to you. Otherwise, I'm not, you know, it's embodied. If you if you don't weave enough weft, the warp gets warped. And so I just tried to keep it on just one channel.
No worries at all. I can read it to you. So there's someone saying in the chat about climate refugees. There's a photo and story project on and about Tuvalu. It will all be gone. The people of Tuvalu are reaching the end of their culture and place with its embodied stories and knowledge. Mm. Then there's someone saying, this morning I finished reading Riders on the Storm. These slides add to the experience, so I plan to read again. It was a lot for me to take in. Thank you, Alistair. And then in Thailand, a lot of Thais are moving towards urban areas. I think that's a phenomenon we can observe in whole of Asia and in Europe. Then in Australia, the pandemic has caused the government to hand out money, putting us more in debt to allow the economy to continue with momentum, promoting consumerism. So then people ask, you know, say about, you know, they agree with you that meaningful relationships have to be created. They say that you're a beautiful storyteller and they thank you for bringing so much soul into this and for mentioning Jung and shadow work. It's important, the weave and the weft. They will remember it.
What would you like me to concentrate on by way of questions, Catherine?
So I would like to raise, there's some questions popping up. So there is someone asking about the cultural trauma, how to release and recover from cultural trauma. So
now how to recover from, goodness me. You know, I'm going to be very naughty. Is this, we'll see, risk if I share screen again. And I'm just going to see if I can pull up in my thing the crude slides, the unsorted slides that I use here. And oops, what have I done? Are you seeing that okay? You're seeing that? Yep.
Budding community.
Right. I'm just going to shoot ahead. How, because the question is, how do you recover from cultural trauma?
Yes.
And so, yeah, I can just use these. This is just my unsorted slides. I didn't want to use too many slides because, you know, it's better if it comes in questions and me just give you a prearranged thing that you could watch on YouTube anytime. So, you know, here we are. Basically, you know, how do you restore community? Well, I'll tell you what we're doing in Scotland. And you mentioned, I think, my book, Soil and Soul. Oh, dear, they're too high up. I'll get the heart back here. And there we are. You mentioned Soil and Soul there, which is the book I wrote in 2001, and it's about community land reform. That, you know, what we've done in Scotland, we had a situation where most of the land was owned by huge landowners, 500 landowners owning sort of 2/3 of the land, something like that. And what we did was we started to challenge that by setting up community land trusts. And that's what a lot of my own work has been involved with. And we've now got 500 of these in Scotland. We've got land reform legislation, which means that when somebody wants to sell land, the community has got the right of first option on it at a government market valuation. And there's also a £10 million Scottish Government land fund that brings land into the hands of communities. So what you've got here now is that, first of all, consciousness has been raised. In this sculpture here, what is being shown is the site of a kind of battle where the people took back the land in the early 20th century. And that is meant to represent the antagonism between the people and the landowning classes. And then finally, they've now got the land back. And they're now doing that, you know, they've got their own 3 wind turbines that produce over $1 million a year that they share out in the community, not for private property profit, but for sharing. And what sculptures like this have done is they have helped people to raise consciousness. They've helped to galvanize it. And now they're teaching about their experience of rebuilding community. So once you get the land back and land is held as a community trust, democratically elected, with directors appointed from within the community, once you get that back, build affordable housing for the young. You can start businesses. You can have your own renewable energy and keep money in the community and so on. But what I wanted to show you especially is that they then took us down. I talked about the Isle Air having struck, and you see that pointer out in the sea there. That's where the rocks are, where the ship drowned, and those 200 men drowned. And that sculpture that you see there, it's at my internet, so I just paused for a moment. That sculpture there represents the rope that a man swam ashore with. And this man managed to swim ashore, and the few of them were saved before the ship lurched and the rest of them drowned. But watch this, because, you know, these Papuans come from the other side of the world. I've just exposed them to this. But they have trauma in their history too. And here the women have gathered around that rope. And Mama Engelina there, who is one of the matriarchs, she's a pastor in her own community, she reaches down and ever so tenderly, as if receiving blessing or giving blessing, she touches the rope. And you know what she says? She says, I'm going to stop sharing now. She says, folks, she says, that rope is how they pulled life back into the community. And whenever I tell that story, I just invite people to think about the rope by which you can pull into the community. And what would be the strand that are pleated together to make that rope? What are the elements that in your community you need to bring life back? And then, you know, it doesn't really matter which strand you work on, which strand you pleat or spin or whatever it might be. In our community, we all function as parts of an emergent whole. And so do what you do, do well, as the old song has it, and dig from where you stand. So, you know, that would be my answer there, Catherine. I've given you an example of something that, you know, it's political, in that, you know, with land reform legislation through in the Scottish Parliament. We've now got 3% of the land in Scotland, 560,000 acres in community land trust, but it's also everything right through to the spiritual. This is about our quality of bearing. This is about the kind of, this is about whether, you know, we're in this only for ourselves, whether we're in it for the good of all. This is about the work of love as life made manifest in these times.
Thank you so much, Alistair. This is really wonderful. I think you answered the question really well. We have now all the questions suddenly popping in. I mean, before there were barely any, and now suddenly we have them all. So I'm gonna read, so the people rate them. So I'm gonna read the ones which are the highest rated. Nancy's asking, how will community reground us if we are not parts of the world where our ancestors were born? Even in the parts of the world where we work. Wow. So she, I think she wants to know more concretely.
Well, okay. You know, take from where you stand. Give you an example, just something that happened today, okay? So here I am, you know, I'm preaching against consumerism and so on. Oops, Jimmy, I've just done something to my screen there. And lo and behold, what happened to us last week, but our microwave oven finally gave up the go. And actually it had, you know, it even had a hole in it. It had corroded through and so on. It finally gave up the ghost. And although I love repairing things, you know, I've always got tubes of glue knocking around on my desk and so on. A microwave oven is not something you try and I should say I approve of microwave ovens because they're so energy efficient. The target energy where you need it. Although I'm aware that some people have got, would see things otherwise. So basically we had to buy a new microwave oven. Well, the first one came and it was too big. Veranda decided it was too big. So, you know, one of these things where you can return it. So we set it up for the return. The second one came And we plugged it in and nothing happened. It was completely dead. So we're a bit sickened by it now. We've not yet ordered the third one. I think we'll go back to firewood. But that meant that I had two huge big boxes, you know, 15 kilograms of microwave to take down to a local shop for a courier to pick up. And I went into the shop and it was one of these Pakistani run grocery shops that we have a lot of here. And the guy looked at me and said, oh, too big. He said, you know, he's only got a little shop. I could see his point. He's only got a little shop. And he said, it's the driver, you know, the driver doesn't like picking up big things as well and so on. And I thought, oh, I'm going to have to find somewhere else across the town to take these two. And I had only carried one of the two in. And then he says, well, look, you know, he said, if you leave it with me, I'll try and persuade the driver. I said, but give me your name and number so I can call you if you won't take it. And I didn't dare say I had another one in the car. I thought, you know, I'll just... I'll take what I'm being given, but I'll have to think of some other way of dealing with the other one. And I gave him my business card. He looks at it. Alistair Mac. He said, are you the author, Alistair McIntosh? And I said, yeah. He says, do you recognize me? And my goodness, you know, years ago, he had a fruit and vegetable shop in a different part of town. And I'd been talking with him about belonging to place and making community. And he'd been so much to it that I went out to the car and got him a copy of Soil and Soul and gave it to him. And he says, you wrote Soil and Soul. And he says, look, leave it with me. I'll talk to the driver and fix it. And I said, actually, you know, I've got another one in the car. He said, bring it in as well. Oh, Catherine, I couldn't believe it. You know, I mean, the poor guy, he's got these two huge boxes with microwaves piled up in his shop. And we were both just so happy. Now, you know, there's somebody, you know, he would have been born in Pakistan because he's of how he speaks English. And you're asking the question that our friend just asked was, how do you make community when you don't belong? You make community in little ways like that. And, you know, once you start looking for it, it just starts happening. I mean, it just starts happening all around you. You know, Ram Dass, the great late American spiritual teacher who many of your people will know, Ram Dass, if in doubt what to do with your life, feed the hungry, literally or metaphorically, feed the hungry. And that will be my bottom line answer as to how you make community if you don't belong. And then what happens, lo and behold, you start belonging. You know, a lot of these folk in the Scottish Land Reform Trust, they're from England or France or further afield, but their way of belonging is to give service to the community. To give service to the community. And then they become the community. That's how it works. That's weaving the weft into the warp of the basket of community.
Thank you so much. I actually have goosebumps when you talk so about building connections around and not only the land, but it's also the people who are surrounding you to build connections, right? That's what you were saying.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. We have Hazel having another question about Jungian shadow. So she's asking, what are your thoughts on the Jungian shadow of multinational companies who collectively might be considered a community themselves? And what can we do about this shadow to create positive change?
Okay. So, you know, one of the things I love about Jung is that he understands that the real spiritual work is not just about the bells and smells and all things bright and beautiful. Right. When I go like that, it means my internet's wobbly. Did you catch what I said there? That, okay. One of the things I love about Jung is that he, un- he understands that, you know, it's not just about bells and smells and all things bright and beautiful, but we do our spiritual work at the cool face of the shadow, the counterpoint of the ego, side of ourselves that we are in denial of, or which has never yet grown into being, or which we've repressed. You know, that's where it happens. And of course, Jung points out that the shadow denied is a shadow we trip up over. If we don't acknowledge our own shadow, we trip up over it. And we do that, we trip up over it because we project it outwards. We project it out onto others. So, you know, I'm deeply aware of the set things up and corrupt the political process by money, lobbying, in order to work to their advantage. However, if we are not to trip on our own shadow, we must also acknowledge the degree to which we may be part of. Every time I shop around looking for the cheapest microwave, I'm driving the competitive paradigm. If I deny that, if I say, oh, it's all the wicked microwave or whatever, if I deny it and I don't acknowledge my own complicity, however small that might be in the greater part of things, I'm not being honest. And then I won't get taken seriously by those working with those issues. And then we lose the capacity for political change that could lead to greater regulation and limitation on the use of politics and what have you. So I think owning our shadow is so great. It's something in, you know, in Writers of the Story I do a lot of. I talk about, you know, corporations and governments are not just entities out there like devils. And, you know, so often you could replace the word devil for corporation and it would just read like a medieval script. They're not just out there, they're also in here. You know, if we've got a pension fund, if we've got money in the bank, if we engage in competitive behavior, we are part of it. And so, you know, let's start by confessing that, and then we can start more easily changing what is not healthy about that. So that would be my answer on the Jungian question, Catherine.
That's brilliant. I actually really like this answer. It makes a lot of sense. So there are a lot of questions right now, and I think part of them have been already.
Hello,
do you hear me?
Yeah, come back.
The internet is quite unstable, so let's try. We still have a minute. And a lot of questions are popping in, but a lot of them have been already answered by you, I feel. You know, you were talking about building community with your, you know, with the locals in urban areas, for instance, because some questions were about London, for instance. A person says it's difficult to foster.
Yes, can I just say that? I noticed that. I noticed that, Catherine. If I can just quickly say that the reason why I now, why Varen and I live in an urban area, we live in a nice house in a hard-pressed part of Glasgow called Govan. And the reason we do that is that we were invited here by people in the local community, and we are involved in a charitable organisation that is community-run called the Galgale Trust. And what we do is we build wooden boats. I'm simplifying, but we build wooden boats and then we get them out in the River Clyde that flows through Glasgow, where the COP26 climate change conference will be held next November, all being well. We get them out onto the water and people, urban people who have been deprived with urban poverty, start reconnecting to their own place. So it's all of that kind of thing, you know, wildlife gardens, you know, these kind of things that you can, window boxes even, you know, all of that kind of thing that you can do. Dig from where you stand, and you'll be amazed how it can grow and grow and grow. Jesus said, the kingdom of heaven is like a tiny seed that when it's planted grows into a mighty tree that harbors many kinds of birds. And that is how we do our community work too.
Is so inspiring. Thank you, Alistair. I think really you have answered, actually, a lot of questions came in, but you have answered them all in what you were telling us in the last 10 minutes, 15 minutes. So I feel, you know, people are saying they're really thanking you. It's very inspirational, soulful. So I think you gave a lot of good tips on how we can try to build, connections in urban areas so we can try to, make small projects with our community, do some, building boats and going on the river, how you mentioned right now is a wonderful idea, for instance, and try to connect within a community in urban lands. So, yeah. Alistair, we are unfortunately running out of time. I really would love to have you here for at least one more hour, even more.
I'll stay here. If you provide the whiskey, I'll stay here all night, Catherine.
We only get started. That's the problem with those one-hour sessions. We only actually getting started. People are really still here. They're still listening.
I'm happy to stay on if we're allowed. Are we allowed to stay on, Catherine?
Unfortunately not.
Oh, well, thank you so much, everybody. And thank you, Catherine. And Eva, in the background, has been doing the technical. Thank you.
They'll stay here with us for a few minutes. We would like to know from you, what would be your top tip of embodiment for us? What can we do to make life easier? And the situations we are in right now in the UK and all over Europe and the world with COVID-19, what would you recommend to us?
Dig from where we stand. I think we have to be aware that the COVID, it's making many people quite emotionally brittle. We easily, if I can generalize, we easily overreact. This kind of Zoom type thing, Catherine, in one way it's wonderful. We've got people here all over the world tonight. In another way, it's quite a narrow emotional bandwidth. We're not rubbing shoulders with each other over a coffee or something like that. And we have to be aware that can run thin. So I think it's so important to reach out to people. I try regularly, I buy cards and I'll send somebody a card, or I'll send them a text, or if I've got time, I'll phone them up. Little connections like that guy in the shop today, I'll make a point of giving time to things like that. And Catherine, you say, well, some of these, it all sounds so small amongst the big things, but what was so wonderful was the parable of the microwave ovens today. Is that if that man hadn't taken them and was going to use his influence with the driver, who he obviously knew, hopefully to take them on and send them back, I would have had a lot of trouble. Now, I could never have anticipated that 10 years ago when I gave him that book. You just don't know how these little seeds planted are going to grow. And it may not, it's rare that you see it coming back to yourself as directly as that. But in the spiritual interconnected picture of things, it doesn't matter. What matters is, you do it to me and I then do it to somebody else. And we're all Buddha nature. We're all branches of the goddess or of the body of Christ, or all Muslims are as one body. I don't care what tradition it is, Catherine, provided it is about a consciousness that is about life as love made manifest. That's the only understanding of God that I'm interested in.